and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Friday, April 12, 2024. A Pan-African advocate urges Africa's regional blocs to stand for the people of Sudan.
But we now have a situation where the continental body is not at its best. That's the African Union and its various organs, institutions, specialized agencies. And unfortunately, the regional mechanisms, in this case, for instance, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, is also not at its best.
And some South Sudanese working at a government printing press say the facility is under siege.
We have been working well. We were rendering services to our country. But when this civil war camp has met our work to come to an end.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Humanitarian agencies warn time is running out for Sudan, which is facing one of the world's worst crises for decades. They warn of catastrophic consequences if no action is taken to enable urgent humanitarian aid to reach the millions of people in need of food and other essential aid. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Sudan has endured a year of war, which humanitarian agencies agree is one of the world's worst man-made disasters. The World Health Organization says the war has had a staggering human cost, with more than 15,000 deaths and an estimated 33,000 injured. The WHO reports about 6.6 million people are displaced inside Sudan and 1.8 million have fled to neighboring countries, making Sudan the largest displacement crisis in the world. The agency warns Sudan also could soon become one of the world's worst hunger crises. Nearly 18 million people are suffering from acute hunger and 5 million more are on the brink of famine. And yet, WHO spokesperson Christian Lindemeyer says this is only the tip of the iceberg of an increasingly desperate situation.
Time is running out. Without a stop to the fighting and unhindered access for the delivery of humanitarian aid, Sudan's crisis will dramatically worsen in the months to come and could impact the whole region. Access for humanitarian actors is particularly constrained, as has been reported so many times by all of the colleagues. Half of the states are not accessible from within Sudan.
He says Darfur and Kordofan are inaccessible and cut off from humanitarian aid. Sudan's National Army and the rival Rapid Support Forces militia began fighting on April 15, 2023, each seeking to control the government. The two sides have made it difficult for aid groups and relief supplies to reach civilians. The International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says the conflict has shattered the basic fabric of everyday life across Sudan. Speaking from Mombasa, Kenya, IFRC head of delegation Farid Abdul Qadir says the country's health system has collapsed and cannot care for the population. He says health facilities lack supplies, equipment, and medical staff, many of whom have been forced to flee their homes.
The humanitarian consequences of the war is dire. It has affected the infrastructure in terms of water supply, in terms of electricity, but worst of all, the people engagement in livelihood and food production, which has both impact now and impact in the future.
The UN Development Program has just released a comprehensive survey of thousands of rural households across Sudan. The study finds the country faces an accelerating food security crisis. The study also warns a famine in Sudan is expected this year, particularly in the states of Khartoum, Al Jazeera, and in the Darfur and Kordofan regions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on Sudan's conflict, Monday, April 15, marks 1 year of instability in Sudan. And that situation has crippled the economy of South Sudan. Some businesses in South Sudan's capital, Juba, are closing down due to ripple effects from the conflict in Sudan. South Sudan's economy, which depends entirely on oil, is hit hard by Sudan's crisis. Some business owners in Juba say they will continue to operate by coming up with new survival tactics. Reporter Juliana Sherpai spoke to owners of small businesses about the magnitude of their challenges.
South Sudan is witnessing serious economic pain after the country cancelled crude oil sales of February and March because of the conflict in Sudan. Fighting has disrupted the flow of crude oil, South Sudan's oil fields, to Port Sudan. Mandela Nelson operates a business in Juba. He says the economic crisis has forced him to develop survival tactics. He says he closed his restaurant, which has been operating since 2019, and now only delivers food to customers.
So when customers, people want to place their outside getting orders and anything that they would like us to make, we'll always prefer them to either call us or they can check on our social media pages, send us a message. Then from there we are able to prepare whatever order that they need. So things are not quite easier, but we also strongly have faith that one day things will be fine.
Amer Niel owns a lingerie shop. She says she's not making any money because most of her customers are affected by the fall of the South Sudan pound against the US dollar.
When you own a shop, so shops are there. Sometimes you go back to your salaries, you boost the shop. You cannot, you'll be boosting the shop for maybe a year or two, but nothing is happening. And for now, I'm actually boosting the shop for my salary, and it's not easy. But I'm keeping up.
Teddy Nambi is a shop attendant at Afro Quality Luxury Boutique. She says the challenges of running a business in Juba are increasing every day.
You can't quit business, though we have to continue. There are things like city council and different revenues. So currently, again, we entered into the dollar rate. The dollar rate today is increasing today, every day, so we can't know which rate should we use. And in the process, we made some losses.
Both customers and the business community complain about the economic situation. Juba resident Christine Michael says the economic crisis in South Sudan has affected her purchasing powers.
Nowadays, if I want to go buy something, I will have to double check what I want to buy and do a small analysis. Like, for example, this is a typically me. I sit down, analyze what I need to buy, list them down. Then I review which one is a priority, which one is a necessity, because we don't have the luxury of just going and buying everything we want or everything we need. Even in the needs, we have to prioritize our needs.
Many South Sudanese business owners are hoping that the conflict in Sudan will end so their country can resume pumping crude oil to the international market. For VOA News, I am Juliana Shapai in Juba.
Still on Sudan, an advocate for human rights says Africa's response to the conflict in Sudan has not produced tangible solutions to the ongoing humanitarian crisis. Donald Deer, chief executive officer of the Pan-African Lawyers Union, a continental group of lawyers, says various African regional blocs took too long to rescue the people of Sudan.
Since the Genuine People's Revolution in 2019 and then the two sets of military coups in 2019 and 2021, and the way the various bodies of the international community, both African and non-African, have handled this matter, it was obvious that we were going to come to this point. So we can't really say we're caught by surprise. And we do know for a fact that especially our Sudanese colleagues, Sudanese civil society and think tanks, had indeed been telling the interlocutors that unless they handle the process properly, it will end in the kind of conflict it has now ended in. So it is really our fault as the international community that we didn't stop this in advance.
And let's talk about continental response. I'm talking about Africa because Sudan is in Africa. How would you gauge the response from African leaders?
I would say, John, that if you look at the major crisis afflicting the continent right now, Sudan is just the worst, but it is not the only one. Africa and African institutions are not at their best right now. We had a glorious honeymoon period 15 years ago, 5 years after the move from the OU to the AU, when all these new norms, all these new instruments, all these new mechanisms we had formed, including the Peace and Security Council of the African Union, were working at their peak. But we now have a situation where the continental body is not at its best. That's the African Union and its various organs, institutions, specialized agencies. And unfortunately, the regional mechanisms, in this case, for instance, the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, IGAD, is also not at its best. So we are having a jumbled, confused, mixed-up response where we don't know who is really leading, whether it is the AU, whether it is IGAD, or who else. We are also seeing initiatives being started by other states, including the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the United States of America. So it is actually a mixed hodgepodge of some things here, some things there, without clarity and without leadership. And no wonder we haven't moved better over the last 1 year on Sudan, or indeed on the other crisis in the Horn of Africa.
The African Union has been touting its motto, solving African problems using African solutions. And you're just telling me it appears like somebody's sleeping on the wheel.
That really is the crux of the matter, John. For us as African citizens and as Pan-Africanists, we actually do believe in African solutions to African problems, or at least African-led solutions to African problems. Because for some of these African problems, it is not just African actors. If you look at Sudan, for instance, we're seeing interests of several states in the Gulf and the Middle East directly meddling on one side or the other, at least between the two major military actors. We also know that many of the powerful states, the P5 states, the permanent five states, are actually also directly involved with interests that are partisan. So it really is an international problem happening in Africa rather than an African problem.
If you look at the issues of accountability, which is close to your heart, what should be done to realize these accountability mechanisms work to deter the men and women in uniform from continuing with crimes that are being reported by aid agencies?
If you look at the law and policy of the African Union itself, because the African Union has the African Union Transitional Justice Policy Framework, they say that very clearly that a transitional justice approach must include all elements, including accountability. And accountability is both at the level of the state, which has the utmost responsibility to protect its citizens, and then at the level of individual perpetrators or groups of perpetrators. The atrocities that we have seen in Sudan over the last 1 year, since the latest outbreak of violence on 15th April 2023, are simply shocking. So we say that the AU has tools, including the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, which it can deploy to carry an urgent fact-finding mission. We can be a mixed mission. They can go on the ground with the protection of the Peace and Security Council of the AU, or they can operate on the margins of Sudan and virtually, because our Sudanese colleagues have collected a lot of information and a lot of evidence of who has been doing what on a day-to-day basis. So accountability should be on the table, both of the state and, when possible, of the individual perpetrators, especially those most responsible for getting us here, especially the respective heads of the Sudanese armed forces and the rapid support forces. The most important message that I'll give to the girls and boys of Sudan, to the women and men of Sudan, is that you are not alone. We fellow Africans are in full solidarity with you in this difficult time in your country. We really admire your courage in how you prosecuted the People's Revolution before it was stolen from you. We know that you are strong. We know that you are resilient. We know that you're doing the best you can in the circumstances. We know that even when civil society has been attacked and discombobulated, you have set up the emergency response rooms, and you are treating each other in the absence of hospitals. You are feeding each other, housing each other, and so on. We will do our best to continue being in solidarity with you and demanding of everybody, IGAD, the AU, individual African member states, and the international community, including the UN, to do better for you.
That's Donald Deyer, Chief Executive Officer for the Pan-African Lawyers Union, a continental group of lawyers. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, earlier today. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, Sudanese Doctors Association say healthcare is a big challenge for people trapped in towns across Sudan. Find out why after the break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. As the people of Sudan witness instability, and this week marks 1 year of a very difficult time in Sudan, Dr. Yasir Al-Amin, a medical doctor and the president of the Sudanese American Physicians Association, tells VOA's Carol Van Damme in recent months, the fighting in and around some parts of the country has intensified and millions of families are displaced as a result of the fighting.
We're talking now about around 25 million people in need of humanitarian aid, so more than half of the population. Hunger is the number one issue in Sudan now. When it comes to healthcare services, where our organization is operating mostly, 60% to 70% of hospitals are non-operational. In some refugee camps, according to MSF Doctors Without Borders, a child dies every 2 hours, every 2 hours. According to the IRC, now Sudan is the number one humanitarian crisis in the world. So sadly, the situation is getting worse by the day.
We heard a few months ago that many of the hospitals and health clinics have closed down because it was just too dangerous. They didn't have enough supplies. Is that the same now, today?
Yes, exactly. Indeed, around 60 to 70% of hospitals are closed. One of the hospitals that we at SAPA were running in Medini Al Jazeera had to shut down in mid of December 2023, a hospital that was providing care to 5,000 patients per month. It has been closed since then. We weren't able to reopen it due to security reasons, and that's the case across the board. Again, almost two-thirds of hospitals in the country are not operational. You have maternity services not being fully provided. Vaccination to kids is not being fully provided. So the health situation in particular, due to lack of funding and due to lack of safe access, is really terrible.
What is your advice, I guess, for people who are still facing injuries and hardship and need to get to a hospital? What should they do if they're stuck in various parts of Sudan because of the fighting?
Well, you know, sadly, at an individual level, there is little that you can do. I remember in the earlier days of the war, in social media platforms like WhatsApp, Sudanese communities were exchanging tips on how a woman can have a safe delivery at home. So it was that bad due to lack of access to hospitals. Our call here is to the warring parties to ensure that there is safe passage of aid. And our call to the international community is to increase its aid to Sudan. The numbers are very clear. The UN has announced that only 5% of its plan for 2024 is funded. Only 5%. Just let this number sink in. 5% of what the UN needs to be able to provide oxygen, medicine, vaccinations, food. The UN has only 5% of that budget.
Some people have called it the forgotten war. Would you agree with that assessment?
I would 100% agree with that. Again, when you look at the humanitarian groups assessment, the IRC assesses this as the number one humanitarian crisis in the world. ACAPS, one of the most respected think tank in humanitarian world, says that the access score is 5 out of 5, meaning that the access is severely limited. And that's why we are going to be rallying in front of the White House on April 15, along with other Sudanese American groups, along with other humanitarian groups, along with other human rights groups, to mark the first year anniversary of the war, and to ask for the American government and for the international community for more aid and for more attention, and for the media to give more attention to this forgotten crisis.
You're expecting a big turnout?
We're hoping so. We have worked very hard towards this day. We've been preparing this for several weeks. We have an amazing group of speakers, including speakers from the Congress, and we're hoping that they're going to be the much-needed media attention and public attention to this forgotten crisis.
That was Dr. Yasir El-Amin, president of the Sudanese American Physicians Association. He was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Houston, Texas. Employees of a government-owned printing press in South Sudan say the closure of the facility in 2018 has affected their careers and their ability to care for their families. They say presidential guards known as Tiger now occupy the Nile printing press, making it impossible for employees to access the premises. For VOA News, Dennis Longoy reports from Juba.
49-year-old Julius Oling was employed at the government printing press way back in 1994 at the age of 26. He says the government should repair printing machines so he can continue to offer his service to the nation. Oling recalls enjoying his work as graphics inspector at the Nile printing press. He says he regrets that all the knowledge he acquired during training in Germany has gone to waste.
The printing press was really helping the nation in printing exams, exercise books for the schools, and then some government documents. So we have been working well. We were rendering services to our country. But when this civil war came, has made our work to come to an end. I'm not happy because we are now redundant. We are not producing things because the government forgot what is supposed to help the government.
Julius Oling, who is a pastor at St. Stephen Episcopal Church in Juba, says the high cost of living has forced him and other employees at the Nile Printing Press to take on odd jobs in order to survive.
Some of our staff, some have become old and they were now retired, and no any other person is sent for training so that can replace those who have retired. In South Sudan, if somebody is retired, I don't know, he goes immediately, he will go and die because even the benefits are not paid. Up to now, pension is not paid to the retired staffs. We have to go to hard labor.
Suzanne Joseph, another Nile printing press staffer, turned to selling charcoal for survival. She says she will continue to struggle without formal employment.
What shall we do? There is no work. The place where we were working at, the Nile printing press, those of Tiger took it. Now, our machines we were working with has been spoiled and crushed by those of Tiger. Even that house has remained empty to date. If we are doing any work, we are only doing handwork like sorting, numbering, and coding. But any work with the machine, it's no longer there.
Christopher Tongun, who is the managing director for Nile Printing Press at the Central Equatoria State Minister of Information and Communication, says he has written several letters to the state governor requesting intervention.
We have tried several times. We wrote to the governor at least so that if we cannot be compensated from that, let the new printing press be open, let it be given a land so that we build. Even if the government cannot manage it, some Samaritans who will be willing to invest on printing so that we at least can continue printing. When that place was taken, it became very difficult for us to follow up. The governor cannot turn up or follow up of these machines.
The spokesman of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces says the Tiger Division, who allegedly occupied the government's printing press, are answerable only to President Salva Kiir's office. This program made repeated calls to Bangasi Joseph Bakasoro, minister in the office of the president, for comment. Those calls were not answered. Luwate William, Director General for General Education and Instruction at the Minister of Education of Central Equatorial State, says his ministry spends thousands of dollars a year to print documents.
It becomes very difficult for us to give enough material for the children to feel a touch of the pages and papers of textbooks, for them to carry with them home to do their homework. Most of these things are in the software already. The syllabuses, the learning modules, the learning framework, the textbooks recommended, which shall be integrated with others, of course. All these are in the soft copy, and most schools do not have the capacity to produce quality.
The Nile Printing Press was a donation from Norwegian Church Aid, NCA, to the Soudan region in the area of United Sudan to cater to the printing needs in Juba, Malakal, and Wau. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonye reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we go to South Africa, where more than half of humanity will be able to vote in elections in 2024. That's more than 4 billion people. 8 of the world's 10 most populous countries will go for polls this year. In Africa, 19 countries, including South Sudan, are set for presidential or general elections. The Media Freedom Group, Reporters Without Borders, has warned that credibility of polls will be threatened by sustained disinformation and misinformation campaigns. Darren Taylor reports for VOA from Johannesburg.
In South Africa, there's audio on social media channels that sounds just like a senior opposition politician, Glynis Breytenbach.
Steenhuisen has taken millions and millions of rands worth of loan from the Bezos Foundation in America.
In the recording, Breytenbach apparently acknowledges that American billionaire Jeff Bezos has given her party, the Democratic Alliance, millions of dollars to defeat the governing African National Congress in coming elections.
I got literally hundreds of emails and WhatsApps asking me if it was in fact correct, which it clearly is not. It's the malicious use of false information, the malicious use of artificial intelligence, spreading a fake, dangerous message that really does influence people.
Breytenbach says the AI-generated audio is designed to present the DA as a slave to global white capitalism and thus an enemy of black South Africans. Helen Grange of Good Governance Africa, a pro-democracy group based in Johannesburg, says what happened to Breytenbach is happening across Africa and the world.
So this is a classic example of misinformation, i.e. manufactured fake news. The other side of the misinformation coin is disinformation, which fits the mold of propaganda.
Grange says Russia is particularly active and successful in undermining democracy in Africa using propaganda. Research by the Center for Strategic Studies in Washington, D.C. shows how Russia used videos that falsely depicted French soldiers saying they were on a mission to recolonize Africa. Russia has denied such allegations, saying they're what it calls Russophobia in Western countries. Grange says in 2023, France withdrew forces from the Sahel, opening a void in the battle against terrorism and creating the potential for Russia to undermine elections in the region later this year. Political analyst Mxolisi Zondo says it's particularly disturbing that senior African political figures are increasingly using disinformation to cast doubt over democratic processes. In this footage, former South African President Jacob Zuma suggests elections are un-African and questions why ballots are always counted in secret. He was speaking at a traditional ceremony in KwaZulu-Natal province. Zondo says Zuma's words are reminiscent of those uttered by many African politicians who feel threatened by democracy.
This is certainly a very scary case of propaganda and disinformation by a former president of the republic who has been elected twice under the same system that is about to elect the next National Assembly and subsequently the president of South Africa. To see a former president cast aspersions in that manner and plant a seed of doubts certainly shows that this is a political game which might end up in a very scary light.
Grange warns that democratic mechanisms for combating fake news are not ready, especially in Africa.
People are susceptible to misinformation and disinformation because as human beings we have a tendency to confirmation bias information that suits our narrative and discount information that doesn't. So for example, a person who's economically disempowered would be particularly susceptible to a fake news article that gives them hope, false as that may be.
The Media Freedom Group, Reporters Without Borders, warns that at least half the elections in Africa this year will not be competitive, in large part because governments maintain strict control over information. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
That report by Darren Taylor from Johannesburg brings us to the end of our show for this Friday, April 12, 2024. We now leave you with Pepe Kale and the song Roger Miller. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. Don't miss our special coverage on Sudan's 1 year of tough time. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer Peter Hindley, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.